Let's turn to Acts 24. Acts chapter 24. We'll finish up the chapter this evening, I hope, talking about Paul before Felix. And this is the second part, remember. In the first part, we noted that we're still talking about and looking at the consequences of Paul's decision to try and placate the legalistic Jewish believers in Jerusalem. And remember back in chapter 21, we noted last time that he was talked into this by the elders of the church down there. And one thing led to another, which led to another, which led to another. And we find ourselves now, Paul will be appearing before Roman judges. And in fact, this decision that Paul made back in Acts chapter 21 determines the course of events for the rest of the book of Acts. And that's what we'll be looking at. And just by way of what's coming up, I think we noted this last time, that the remainder of Acts that we have to study centers around two sections. First, Paul before the Roman judges, and that's chapter 24 through 26. We have Paul before Felix that we're looking at now in chapter 24. And then in chapter 25, we'll see Paul appearing before Festus to defend himself. And then that's down through chapter 2 of, or 22 of, verse 22 of chapter 25. And then from there, 25, 23 through 26, Paul will be appearing before Agrippa. And then after that, we'll have Paul's trip to Rome in chapter 27 and 28. And that will conclude up the book of Acts then. In 27, the journey begins. We'll have Paul setting out for Rome. And then in 28, 1 through 10, we'll have a delay. And then he'll complete the journey in 28, 11 through 31. And that'll be the book of Acts then. And it won't be a whole lot longer in the book of Acts, because a lot of what we have coming up is travelogue type things that go rather quickly. So we'll be finishing up. I won't even make a guess as to how long it'll be, but won't be too long. So Paul before Felix is where we're at. Last time we looked at the charges in verses 1 through 9. We'll review those this evening. And then this evening we'll look at Paul's defense. How does he answer these charges? And he'll answer them one by one. There were three charges, you'll remember, and we'll look at them in a moment. And then the response, we'll have Felix's response in verse 22 through 27. So just by way of review, first the charges. Remember in verse 1 through 4, we had an introduction. It's 24, verse 1 says, "After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders, with an attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. After Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, 'Since we have, through you, attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. But that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing.'" As you read through that, you can just see him rubbing his hands together, can't you? These flattering words that he says to Felix. Now, normally, the high priest himself was the one who presented the charges in a case like this, but Ananias brought a lawyer along with him. He brought his mouthpiece because he was really, really angry at Paul. Remember, Paul had insulted him right in front of the Sanhedrin. Chapter 23 and verse 3, Paul said to him, "Then Paul said to him, 'God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit and try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck?'" So apparently Ananias was quite offended by that, and he brought a lawyer along to make sure that Paul really got what he thought was coming to him. Now, two things to remember as we looked at the charges and as we look at the response. there are two things we need to keep in mind. And the first one is that the charges were devious. We'll see that Tertullus plays up the emotional angle. It's not going to be strictly according to law. In fact, in verse 5, he says, "For we have found this man a real pest." That's not really a point of law, calling Paul a pest. And in fact, that word pest we'll get to in a moment. We looked at it last week. There'll be three charges. Oh, the other thing to remember before we get into the charges is that the judge was corrupt. So we have a devious charges and a corrupt judge. In fact, Felix was notorious for being corrupt. He wasn't just corrupt. He was well noted for that. Tacitus, the Roman historian, described him as one who exercised the powers of a king with the mind of a slave. We went through the flattery in verses 2 through 4. Now, again, it was customary at this time to begin a speech before a judge or before someone you were appearing before. It was customary to give a polite compliment. Now, this we have from Tertullus goes quite beyond that, as you can see. He says, "Since we have through you," in verse 2, "attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation," that would be something that the rank and file Jew wouldn't agree with. They didn't like him all that well. It was blatant flattery. Now, Paul's going to begin his defense with a compliment, but it won't be just flattery. It'll be factual, and we'll see that when we get down to verse 10. But then the charges that they leveled against Paul are going to be threefold. And first, Tertullus starts out with an insult in verse 5. He says, "For we have found this man a real pest." A real pest is literally a diseased bird of prey. So it's an insult. He insults him. He proceeds then to the first charge. And the first charge is that he stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. And that throughout the world would refer to the Roman Empire. And while it's true, in one sense, that Paul had stirred up dissension among the Jews throughout the Roman Empire, the dissension he stirred up was not against Rome. It was against him and against Christianity. So the plan of Tertullus is to make the case one of politics rather than religion. He's going to say Paul is trying to overthrow the government of Rome. That's what the implication is here. Now, Paul obviously was not trying to overthrow the government of Rome. He was proclaiming the gospel. And this caused a lot of disturbance among the Jews, but it had nothing to do with sedition. It had nothing to do with taking over the government. Now, the second charge they level against him is that he's a ringleader of the Nazarenes. And the Nazarenes would be a group which had no legal status under Roman law. And what they're trying to do by this charge is to say Paul is not a Jew. He's a Nazarene. And they're making a distinction there. And that distinction didn't really exist at that time. But that's what they were doing. They were trying to separate Paul from Judaism. Because if they can do that, if Paul is proclaiming a religion that has no legal status under Roman law, then he could be in trouble. But Judaism was protected under Roman law. So they're trying to make it look like he's not really a Jew. He's a ringleader of this Nazarene group. The third charge is desecration of the temple. You might wonder, why would they even bring that up to Romans? In verse 6 it says, "And he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him." The reason they brought that up was because if someone had desecrated the temple, it was customary for the Roman officials to go along with the death penalty. So they had that. They have two charges that were punishable by death under Roman law: rebellion or sedition, and then being a ringleader of a religio illicita group, a group that had no status under Roman law. Those were punishable by death under Roman law. And then desecration of the temple was punishable by death under Jewish law. So they had him three ways from Sunday, as we used to say. They had every charge they could possibly think of against him. And we're hoping for a death penalty, I'm sure. Remember back in chapter 21, this charge of desecrating the temple came about because of a rumor. And we'll see that when Paul makes his defense, the ones who accused him of this weren't even there. They weren't even at the trial. But remember back in chapter 21 and verse 27, it says, "When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, 'Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place.'" Of course, non-Jews were not allowed in the temple. And in verse 29, it explains why they said that. It says, "For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple." So the charge was based on a rumor. Nobody had even seen it. And in fact, when they come to place the charges, the Asian Jews, the ones who were so upset about that, aren't even there. We don't see them again. In chapter 24, it's the high priest Ananias, and he has some elders with him, and the attorney named Tertullus. Doesn't say anything about the Asian Jews that were so upset about this. So now we get to Paul's defense, and that'll be in verse 10 through 21. Paul will defend himself, and he defends each of these charges in order. Let's read the verses first, starting at chapter 24 and verse 10. "When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, 'Knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship, neither in the temple nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself, did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience, both before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified, without any crowd or uproar. But there were some Jews from Asia, who ought to have been present before you, and to make accusation, if they should have anything against me, or else let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council, other than for this one statement, for which I shouted out while standing among them, 'For the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today.'" First, his defense against the charge of rebellion or sedition will be in chapter 24, verse 10 through 13. Now notice, the Roman court is very orderly. Verse 10, "When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded." So we have an orderly trial going on here. Compare this. Look at chapter 23 and verse 2. "When he was on trial before the Jews," who are supposedly the religious people, the good people, "it was utter pandemonium. 23:2, the high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth." Not very orderly at all. Verse 7, As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. And then in verse 9, and there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man." In verse 10, and as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. That's the kind of justice Paul got in front of the religious group. Now we get in front of the Romans, and here Felix says, "Okay, Paul, we've heard the charges. Now it's your turn." And he can respond, and he's allowed to respond in an orderly manner. So Paul follows the custom of complimenting the judge, but his compliments are courteous, but they're also objective. They're not just blatant flattery like Tertullus' compliments were back in the first part of chapter 24. Paul credits Felix in verse 10, knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation. That's true. I mean, it was true. I cheerfully make my defense. So he credits Felix with knowledge and with experience, which Felix had. So he followed the custom without being dishonest. Now, Paul's first defense against this charge of rebellion is, one, that he's been away from Jerusalem, and two, that he'd only come back recently. First, verse 11, he says, "Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship." And he points out the purpose of his visit up to Jerusalem wasn't to start a rebellion, it was to worship. And in fact, Paul was in Jerusalem for Pentecost. Remember back in chapter 20, look back at chapter 20 and verse 16, when Paul was coming back on his third missionary journey and he's heading back to Jerusalem, he makes a note in verse 16 that says, "For Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be in Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost." So remember, he went past Ephesus and stopped in Miletus instead and had the elders come down to say goodbye to him, because he was on a hurry to get to Jerusalem so he could be there by Pentecost. So that's why he was down in Jerusalem. It wasn't to start a riot. It wasn't to start a rebellion. It was for Pentecost. Now, remember, the case of the Jews hangs on the fact that Paul is a political offender and not a religious one. They want the Romans to think that Paul was trying to start a rebellion against the Roman Empire. So Paul points out, and it's very important that he points out, that Felix understood what the purpose of his trip down to Jerusalem was. Remember, he'd taken up a collection for the poor saints in Jerusalem, and he's going to mention that. He came there to bring that to them and for Pentecost. So the purpose of his visit was spiritual. It was not political. Now, the next thing he points out is that it was no more than 12 days ago that he even arrived in Jerusalem. So 12 days is hardly enough time to instigate a rebellion against the Roman Empire. I mean, he just didn't have time to do that. Now, during this time, he makes a statement in verse 12, "Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself, did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot." Now, you might think, well, does that mean Paul didn't say anything to anybody? Well, actually, no. The word discussion is a word that's often used for public speaking. He's not saying he didn't talk to anybody. He's saying that he didn't have any public speaking. Look at Acts 17. We'll look at a few examples of the same word. We find in Acts 17, it says, "Now when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And according to Paul's custom, he went to them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures." That's the same word. The word is dialegomai. Dialegomai. And look down at verse 17. It says, so he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. You see, this is a public speaking type thing. In chapter 18 in verse 4, it says, and he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Verse 19 of chapter 18 says, they came to Ephesus, and he left them there. Now he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. Or chapter 20 in verse 7, it says, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight. So the word dialegomai refers to public speaking. And it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that Paul's habit was always to go down to the synagogue and speak publicly to the Jews. And the only place he didn't do it in Jerusalem was where he was accused of trying to start a rebellion. So verse 12, he says, neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or speaking publicly. The idea is against the Roman Empire. Now in verse 13, he rebuts the argument simply by saying, they don't have any proof. Verse 13, nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. Prove is a kind of an interesting word. It's paristemi. Paristemi means to place beside. To place beside. Now, in this context, in this usage, it means to place evidence beside their accusation. So it has the idea of prove. They can't place any evidence with their accusations. All they can do is say that Paul was starting a rebellion. They have no proof whatsoever, is the idea. Now the second charge, remember they had charged him with being a ringleader of the Nazarenes. And the key to this charge was that the Nazarenes were not recognized as a religious group by the Roman Empire. So they were trying to say he was practicing an illegal religion. Now, in fact, the Nazarenes were a sect of Judaism. So his defense is going to change now. First, his first defense is denial. He said, I did not have anything to do with a rebellion, and what these guys are saying is absolutely wrong. Now, his defense here is going to be a little bit different. He's going to say, okay, if you say that I'm a Nazarene, well, I'm going to tell you what I believe. And what he believes is strictly according to the Old Testament. So Paul now, he's going to get down to the real reason why Ananias and the Jewish elders oppose him. And it's not because of his political position. It's because of his teaching, about his interpretation of the Old Testament and his statement that Jesus is the Messiah and that that was proved by the resurrection. So his argument is going to be this. These guys are saying that I'm guilty of practicing an illegal religion. Well, the way, as he calls Christianity here, he's going to say, is in complete harmony with all the Jewish scriptures. It is a protected religion under Roman law. So he's going to show that the evaluation of the Jewish court, remember when he stood before the Sanhedrin, concerning what he is proclaiming was wrong. So he says first, he worships the God of Israel. Verse 14. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers. The God of our fathers. So that's a very Jewish way of saying God. And what he's saying here is that Christians do not worship a new God. We don't worship a different God than the Jews. We believe the Old Testament is true. Paul has not abandoned the God of the Hebrew Scriptures. He goes on to say, too, he does not deny the Old Testament. He says, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets. Well, he says, I believe the Old Testament, same as these guys do. In fact, in verse 14, he says, everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, the word written there is a perfect tense. And what that means is that it's completely, permanently written in the Old Testament. He believes that. So he's not worshiping a new God. He doesn't have a new Bible. Or he hasn't abandoned the Old Testament, I should say. And he has the same hope as his accusers in verse 15, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves. Now, you have to stop back and think here, because he goes on to say that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. Ananias and the Sadducees, they didn't share the hope of the resurrection. In fact, they didn't even believe in resurrection. But it was part of Jewish orthodoxy. I mean, to say that someone isn't Jewish because he believes in the resurrection, if they said that, they would have to get rid of all the Pharisees too, and they couldn't do that, because the Pharisees were part of Jewish orthodoxy. But the basic hope of the Jews was what? What's the basic hope of the Jews? Throughout the whole Old Testament, what were they looking for? The Messiah. Yeah, that's what the hope of their, that he shares with them. Look at chapter 26 and verse 6. You can see that that's what he has in mind in verse 6 and 7, and then we'll look down at verse 22. But in verse 6 it says, and now I am standing trial for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers. So he's talking about the same hope again. The promise to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day. And for this hope, O king, I am being accused by the Jews. Why is it considered incredible among you people if God does raise the dead? Now look down at verse 22. He says, so having obtained help from God, I stand to this day testifying both to small and great, stating nothing but what the prophets and Moses said was going to take place, that the Christ was to suffer, and that by reason of his resurrection from the dead, he would be the first to proclaim light both to Jewish people and to the Gentiles. So, he's talking about the Jewish hope there, and see how he links that with the Messiah. Because that was the hope of all Jews, the Messiah. Whether they believed in resurrection or not, they did believe in Messiah. So Paul, back in chapter 24, as he's addressing Felix, he's talking about this hope, and he does believe in resurrection, of course, being a believer. So he says in verse 15, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves. And then goes on to say that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. Kind of saying these guys are wrong about that, but they both cherish the same hope. Now, he goes on to say and to stress in verse 16 that his conscience is clear. He says, in view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience, both before God and before men. So his conscience is clear. Now he's going to defend himself against the charge of defiling the temple. And that'll be in verses 17 through 21. Paul's defense against this charge is going to be twofold. He's going to have two arguments to rebut the defense that he defiled the temple. And the first one is that he's completely innocent of the charges. And the second one's going to be, well, my accusers aren't even here to accuse me of the charges. So the first one is that he is innocent of the charges. Verse 17. Now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd or uproar. So there were some Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you. See, there's the second charge. But first, he says that what he was doing in Jerusalem was absolutely legitimate. He wasn't there for any devious purposes. He wasn't there to try and start a rebellion. He was down in the temple worshiping. He had brought the monetary gift from the churches to the believers in Jerusalem to bring offerings, he says, to bring alms to my nation. That's the collection they took for the saints in Jerusalem, and to present offerings, which is what he was doing down at the temple. And he was not only that, but he was ceremonially clean. Verse 18, he points that out, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd or uproar. So he had every reason and every right to be in the temple. He did not defile the temple. I mean, he was ceremonially clean when he entered the temple. He was there to make an offering. He had every right to be there. And then he goes on to say in verse 19, or the last part of verse 18, it says, but there were some Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you and to make accusation if they should have anything against me. So he says, these guys who said I defiled the temple aren't even here to make the accusation. Now, Roman law was somewhat like ours in that circumstance, because Roman law, in fact, they provided punishment for accusers that didn't show up in court. I mean, you couldn't go just accuse somebody, and then when he goes to court, you're not there. You know, we do the same thing in our justice system. You can't just go around accusing people and then not show up to make your accusation in court. And just like in our justice system, if somebody did that, the charges were most often dropped. You don't have any witnesses. There's no proof. When you read that, you kind of ask yourself, well, Tertullus was a lawyer. He should have known that. Why didn't he bring these guys along? Well, I have to assume that Tertullus knew that they would be bad witnesses because the charges weren't true. You know, they didn't want bad witnesses to appear, so he thought it best to just leave them behind altogether. Now, after those defenses, reading of verse 20 says, or else let these men themselves tell you what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. And of course, they found no misdeeds. It was what? Other than for this one statement which I shouted out while standing among them. Remember when he was before the Sanhedrin and he mentioned the resurrection, the Sadducees and Pharisees got into a pretty much a brawl, and they had to pull Paul out before they tore him to pieces. So he says, for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today. So that was the kind of the bottom line. He didn't do anything wrong. They just got bent out of shape because of what he said. So Felix responds, and he responds both with a public statement, and then he'll have private conversations with Paul as well. His public statement is verse 22 and 23, where it says, but Felix, having a more exact knowledge about the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias, the commander, comes down, I will decide your case. Then he gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody and yet to have some freedom and not to prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. So he's kind of under house arrest. It's kind of the idea, not really in a jail cell, not being mistreated. But Felix puts off the case until Lysias, the commander of the Jerusalem garrison, could come down and testify. Now, Felix, we note, has a knowledge of the truth. It says, Felix having a more exact knowledge about the way. So he had some knowledge about this. He also had a fear of the truth, as we'll find down at verse 25. We don't really know why Felix put this off. You can kind of imagine a couple of reasons. One of them could have been quite practical. I mean, here we have Tertullus on one side and Paul on the other, and they're saying conflicting things. Tertullus is saying that Paul was trying to start a rebellion against Rome. And Paul says, no, I wasn't. I was down there to worship. So he might have been just, well, let's wait until Lysias gets here. Maybe he can shed some light on this. The text doesn't say whether he ever did come down to testify or not, or if Felix ever resumed the trial. They never completed it. It might have been simply a delaying tactic, too. I mean, Felix might have been, if I let Paul go, there really aren't any charges. There's no case against him. But if I let him go, then the Sanhedrin's going to be mad, and they're kind of a powerful group. So maybe I can just put this off, you know, and wait till later to have to deal with it. We don't know, but it never did actually come to a conclusion. But he does go on to have some conversations with Paul in verse 24 through 27. Verse 24, it says, "But some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. But as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, 'Go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you.' At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him. But after 2 years passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison." Now, apparently, Felix and Drusilla, his wife, wanted to have some abstract conversations about Christianity with Paul. And when you read this, it's kind of funny, because I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but it's kind of typical, I guess I want to say. Paul's proclamation of Jesus Christ kind of took a personal turn here, and they didn't like it. In fact, they got scared. In verse 25, it says, "But as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come," so here's Felix and Drusilla, "Is there a God?" Being really abstract and about it and want to have this big intellectual discussion. And Paul says, "Yes, there's a God, and you know what? You're guilty before him, and he's a righteous God, and, you know, you are morally responsible." Of course, nobody likes that. Have you ever had that experience? People want to talk about God, but when you get down to the part about Christianity has moral implications, they kind of back off. Wait a minute, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about God and spiritual things. And that's what happened to Paul. Here we have Felix and Drusilla wanting to talk to him, but then he gets down to the brass tacks, as we say, and he's talking about their responsibility, their moral responsibility before a righteous God. That they don't like. The content of his proclamation is righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. First, he says faith in Jesus Christ in verse 24. That preposition, that in, faith in Christ Jesus, is the Greek preposition eis. It means direction towards. So what it's talking about, faith in the proper direction towards Jesus Christ, is what brings salvation. So that's what he's talking about. He's talking about righteousness, the result of a properly directed faith, righteousness that God provides to believers, self-control, the judgment to come, what faces those who don't have the righteousness that God provides. So these things got really personal, so they had the effect of frightening Felix. But notice in verse 26, his courage comes back when he calls Paul back to get a bribe out of him, that kind of bolsters his courage. It says, "At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him." So apparently, he thought that Paul was still a wealthy man, so he was expecting a bribe. F.F. Bruce has this to say about this verse, and it's kind of interesting. It says, "In spite of the stern and reiterated edicts prohibiting bribery, the wheels of Roman law in those days ran more smoothly if they were judiciously greased." technically it was against the law to bribe, but Felix wanted to bribe anyway. Then in verse 27, we have the change of the governor and find out that Felix is succeeded by Festus. Now, this didn't have any impact on Paul because Felix, it says in the last part of the verse, left Paul imprisoned. Festus, now we'll find, was the procurator or governor of Judea from the year 59 until his death in 61. So he wasn't a very long-term governor. But again, not much advantage for Paul since Felix left him imprisoned. But now Paul is going to have to defend himself before Festus. And that'll be chapter 25. And that's what we'll start on next week. So we'll pick up then next week with chapter 25, Paul before Festus, the new governor, the new procurator of Judea. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for your inspired church history in this book of Acts. And thank you for the apostle Paul who made his defense before these Romans. And we have this to read and to study and to see how he handled himself in the light of opposition. Father, we pray that we can be like him, and pray most of all that we can be like Christ. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.